Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. It is a hard fact of life that if we live long enough, we or those we love will receive a devastating medical diagnosis. How we cope in such difficult circumstances can both impact the course of our personal recovery and, in some cases, uplift the human condition. Christian apologist and journalist Megan Basham has walked this difficult road. Just after Thanksgiving last year, she was diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer, which radically changed the expected course of her life. Since then, in an impressive display of courage and leadership, she has publicly shared how the disease and treatment impacted her life, her family, her career, and the importance of faith in tough circumstances. Basham is here to share the insights that she has gained from, in essence, walking through the valley of the shadow of death. She will also be sharing her reaction to the assassination of her friend Charlie Kirk and the world's response to his murder. Basham is a New York Times bestselling author and a culture reporter with The Daily Wire, where she contributes regularly to the top 10 news podcast, Morning Wire. For 13 years, she wrote for World Magazine, and her work has also appeared in such outlets as The Wall Street Journal, The Telegraph, First Things, and National Review, among others. She has appeared as a commentator on Fox News, MSNBC, BBC, CBN, and The Today Show, as well as numerous regional TV and radio news broadcasts. Basham was previously a Novak Journalism Fellow and a Lincoln Fellow at the Claremont Institute for the Study of Statesmanship and Political Philosophy, and is the recipient of the Association of Classical Christian Schools Boniface Award and Concerned Women for America's Defending Truth Award. She is the author of Beside Every Successful Man and, most recently, Shepherds for Sale, How Evangelical Leaders Traded the Truth for a Leftist Agenda. Basham lives in Charlotte, North Carolina, with her husband, Brian, and their two daughters. Megan, welcome to Humanize.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Wesley. I've listened to the show a number of times and grateful to be here.
Well, thank you so much. You know, you're a journalist and an author. Why did you choose a writer's life?
You know, I don't know that I ever had a deliberate plan to do that. I worked on my college paper. I was an English lit major. I just always loved reading and words. And when I graduated from college, I got married shortly after. And my husband was in mainstream broadcasting. So if you know anything about that world, it's a little like the military. You move a lot. You start in small markets for like a year or two, and then you'll move up to a bigger market and a bigger market. And so, you know, with all those moves, I mean, we probably moved, gosh, 5 or 6 times in the first 15 years of our marriage. So there, it was something I could do without having, you know, a formal go to the office job. So I could freelance, I could submit articles. And then when I got to know people at World, it was just a really great arrangement for both of us because I could work as little or as much as I wanted from my house. And it's also very conducive to having babies and being a mom. So it just really worked out. You know, God just kind of put me in that position and I always enjoyed the work.
Breaking into journalism and becoming a successful writer isn't easy. How did you manage it?
You know, I'm going to be honest, it really felt like anytime there was a major breakthrough, God kind of dropped it in my lap. You know, I was always passionate about politics, passionate about my views. So I was very ambitious about submitting articles to places like National Review and Wall Street Journal and at the time Town Hall. So, you know, part of it was almost like I couldn't be quiet. I couldn't contain those opinions and keep them to myself. So to keep from ranting at my family all the time, sometimes I would write them down and submit them to publication. But in terms of the books that came along, that was it truly was a gift from God. I remember for my first book, Beside Every Successful Man, I had been writing some columns that were close to my heart as a young wife and mother about what I wanted our lives to look like. You know, I wanted to help my husband's success in his career ambitions. And I did a lot of that and talking to other young women who were also looking for flexibility. You know, they wanted to work some or maybe not at all, but they didn't necessarily feel that they had that option financially. So it was a desire to try to solve a problem I was working on for myself and my friends. And as I was talking about it publicly, a publisher just came to me and said, hey, this would make a great book. And the exact same thing happened with my second book. I was writing articles about what I saw happening in the church, particularly around COVID at that time. And an editor approached me and said, do you think you have a book here? Because we think you have a book here. And so both times it kind of felt like it was just a nudge from the Lord going, you're going to write this book now.
Well, it's always good when an editor comes to you. I've had that experience, and I've also had the experience of trying to sell a book.
Yes.
And they're very different experiences, let me tell you. You speak and write often about your faith. Were you raised a Christian or did you experience a conversion?
Both. So I was raised a Christian, non-denominational, strong, Jesus-following parents. We were in church every Sunday, but I was very much the prodigal. So when I hit college, colloquially, I'll say I was a party girl, to put it nicely, at Arizona State, which is a place for party girls. And I indulged heavily. And thank God, actually, because of my English lit major, that was what brought me back. I really kind of fell into a pit of drug addiction, alcohol abuse when I was 21, 22. And I was just in a miserable state. And it got to the point where, you know, I had been arrested a couple of times for DUI. Yeah, people are always seem a little surprised at this part of my background. If you remember Joe Arpaio and the old Tent City jail that he was famous for in Arizona, I was there.
Oh, my.
Yes. So when it was hitting the news, you know, my husband likes to joke about it now. And I'm like, I don't want to joke about this. He's like, really? It's not funny after 20 years that you were in the pink underwear at the Tent City. But
what happened? What happened to turn you around?
So it was in a class with a Bible is Lit and doing some survey classes as well for my English Lit degree. And I happened to get an assignment to contrast the original Vulgate cycle of the Lancelot Guinevere romance versus Thomas Mallory's version. And anyone who's an English Lit major will know that in the Mallory version, he sort of strips all of this religious language and teaching that was in the original. So in the original, Lancelot and Guinevere's love story is not presented as this romantic star-crossed romance. It's actually presented as debased sin. And so you have all of these hermits in the original coming out and confronting Lancelot as this child of extreme fortune. He was handsome. He was wealthy. He had been gifted all of these wonderful things from his Christian parents that had been handed down to him as his cultural inheritance. And he debases himself, turns his back on all of that to indulge these sinful passions with Guinevere. Thomas Mallory took all of that out. So when we were supposed to contrast them and write about how Thomas Mallory's version was so much better without all of that moralizing. But when I sat and read them, I remember it so well. I was in my parents' house. I was reading the Hermit's Rebukes of Lancelot. And I just went, this is me. This is what I am. I am debased. I am indulging in all of this sin. And I literally got down on my knees and prayed, Lord, help me. I mean, at least, and that was a good thing about my Christian upbringing is I knew where to go. I knew what to do in that moment where I was just sort of overwhelmed by conviction. And I don't know, because I was raised in a Christian home and would have said I was a Christian before then, if that was, you know, the moment of sealing of the Holy Spirit for me. But I know that was the moment that I had a sustained interest in spiritual things and began to walk with the Lord consistently. So I look back probably on that moment as my likely salvation.
I bet the author would be thrilled to hear that, because it sounds to me like that might have been one of his purposes.
Yes. And I've actually said, isn't that amazing that, you know, this theologian, this Bible teacher through centuries reaches forward from, you know, I don't remember now anymore because it's been a lot of years, but maybe the 11th century or something, and touches this girl in 21st century America and convicts her heart in the same way that he was trying to convict the hearts of those readers in the Middle Ages. And I love that image.
It's one thing to become a Christian. It's another to become quite so public about it and public figure with regard to your faith. What made you decide to actually walk that? Because you get a lot of brickbats when you start doing things like that.
Yeah, I don't know that it was a decision. I've always just written about the things that were foremost in my life and that I cared about most. So for that reason, I often covered a lot of family and marriage issues. And then I also covered a lot of faith issues because that was where I lived and what my mind was occupied with. So it wasn't like there was ever really a decision. Again, it was just something that evolved naturally on its own because this was what I was personally living. And so that was what I was personally interested in.
You seem to wear two hats. You work for the conservative Daily Wire as its cultural reporter. The Daily Wire is not a religious outlet, correct?
Correct.
And then you also do, especially on Twitter and so forth, and in your books, a lot of Christian argumentation, if you will. Which of the two hats do you think predominates in your work?
Probably my faith hat. But I don't separate them cleanly. You know, I mean, when you look at like the Daily Wire, yes, it's political, it's conservative, but they have a lot of room for writing about Christianity and how faith impacts our policies, because obviously you can't really neatly separate those things. When you look at issues like the sanctity of human life or the created order of male and female or even private property rights, you look at something that the Bible speaks to. And speaks to clearly. And so, you know, as a Christian, when you write about these things, I would never want to say that, you know, what God's wisdom is on these particular issues isn't relevant or like we can't touch that. So for me, that's always, you know, my first and primary guidance. Before I get to what should our tax policy be and what do these experts say, I'm always going to go, what does scripture say about this? How do I interpret do not covet? Do not envy your neighbor's stuff. Do not steal. So you know, those are probably the first things that I always turn to. And so again, it's just so organic. I don't sit there and go, okay, this is now a political column and this is a faith column. It's all intertwined. And I don't think you can separate it.
Because you have a consistent life belief, a consistent philosophy.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think it's consistent. I'm sure there's moments where I've shifted or changed, but yeah, absolutely. Everything. I mean, it's the Kuiperian every square inch. Everything is shaped by what I believe spiritually.
Well, let's talk about what happened in 2024. Your career was really soaring, and I was noticing, because I follow you on Twitter and so forth, I was noticing how well you were doing. Shepherds for Sale came out. Which became a bestseller, I believe. In June of that year, you received the Boniface Award from the Association of Classic Christian Schools for Fearless and Faithful Journalism. Then just after Thanksgiving, you were hit with a cancer diagnosis. Yeah. That's a real, like hitting a wall when you were just really taking off. Describe what happened and how you reacted and your family.
Yeah, it was 2024 was a very strange year. I mean, a roller coaster of a year where you just sit back and go, what's happening here, Lord? Because I didn't know, and I still don't necessarily know what God's plans were for that. As I mentioned, I hadn't gone looking for that book contract. It was just kind of dropped into my lap. I was writing about these things that I was so passionate about that I couldn't contain it and keep it to myself. So the book comes out, it hits the bestseller list. I had been having, if we back up to March of 2024, I had at that point been having symptoms and digestive issues for a while. And to the point that, you know, one night I was having terrible stomach cramps and I told my husband, we got to go to the emergency room. I'm just in excruciating pain. We thought maybe it was kidney stones, didn't know what was going on. Got to the emergency room in March of 2024 and I have cancer in my family. So both my grandmother and my aunt died of ovarian cancer. So I've always had cancer kind of on the brain. And I asked them at the emergency room, could this be cancer related? And they did a scan and they told me, no, it wasn't. So they didn't see anything at that point. So, you know, we go into book launch then because we're just a couple of months from the book coming out in June.
Did your symptoms abate?
No, they didn't. And this was also the summer of the election. So it was the Republican National Committee. So I was running kind of all over the country for book promotion and also for coverage for the Daily Wire of the election that year, going to the Republican National Convention, doing other events like that. And through all of it, I was continuing to have these symptoms. And so when the book came out, hit the bestseller list, it's just, I'm busy. I'm trying to, you know, make the diet recommendation changes that they gave me at the hospital. And I actually did pursue a couple more appointments to go, what's going on here with my primary care and a gastroenterologist? And, you know, they kept telling me my symptoms did not align because at every appointment I would say, could this be cancer? And they're like, no, your symptoms don't really align with that. And you know, you'll have a birthday and then you'll have your colonoscopy and we don't really see any reason to move the colonoscopy up. So I was just trying to navigate these symptoms while I was doing all of this other activity. And I'll be honest, it was not easy. I mean, I was having a lot of digestive issues. And so I'm navigating this. I'm trying to manage it. they're telling me I don't need to get a colonoscopy right away. So then come November, it's finally time for me to get this colonoscopy that I had.
So you had a 6-month wait approximately to get a colonoscopy?
Yeah. Yep. That's so because I didn't have
astounding considering that you were having symptoms though.
Yes. And again and again, they kept telling me that the symptoms that I had weren't the symptoms that would alarm the gastroenterologist or immediately trigger a colonoscopy. So when I finally got it in November, and it was the day before Thanksgiving, I expected after these appointments for them to say, yeah, as we thought, it's, you know, diet changes or you have IBS or something. I woke up and you could see that the doctor was very alarmed. And he said, we found a large tumor. And he didn't mince any words with me. He said, I'm quite certain it's cancerous. I mean, you know, we're going to biopsy it, but I'm quite certain it's cancerous. And then spending, you know, the long Thanksgiving holiday weekend. So, I mean, it was nearly a week before I talked to anybody again after that.
Let me interrupt because, you know, a lot of people are terrified of having what happened to you happen mm-hmm. to them. So that must have, what was your reaction when the doctor said, well, guess what? You know, the questions you've been asking were right. And this is a serious situation. I mean, that must have been like a punch in the stomach. And how did your faith alleviate that? Or was it just like raw fear? Explain what happened there.
Raw fear is a good way to explain it. I knew just, you know, you can just sort of pick things up based on the doctor's demeanor and the words that he used. And, you know, I'm an overanalyst by nature. And I think that probably comes with the territory of what I do. And so, you know, I'm reflecting on every word he said. And my husband's kind of trying to talk me down out of the tree because I could tell it was bad by the way that the doctor said, we found a large tumor. And, you know, not just that it's cancerous, we think it's probably advanced. So I knew it was bad. And compounding that was I had had a friend the year before who was younger than me, 42 at the time that she died. Almost the same exact story happened. She had two young children. She went in for stomach pains and they found that she had stage 4 cancer. And within a year, she was gone. So that was very much at the forefront of my mind that, sure. You know, my friend Ashley had the exact same diagnosis. And we lost her within a year. So I can tell you that was probably the darkest night of the soul that week that I have ever experienced. I will also say that in God's kindness, providentially, we had some friends who have been our dear friends for many, many years before we were married, came to stay with us that Thanksgiving. And they had been through a terrible cancer journey. He had been diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma, stage 3 Ewing sarcoma as an adult, which is pretty unusual for an adult, and had been through much rougher treatment, actually, than I had to go through. But they held my hand through all of it. You know, I mean, they're strong Christians. And so they were giving me all of the Bible verses, all of the studies that he had used to meditate on, that they had used to get through his cancer scare. They were immediately telling me, you know, here's the people that you need to contact. You know, how you get onto my chart. Here's, you know, the best oncologist in this area. And so that was helpful. But I can tell you, I mean, that was about as frightened as I've ever been in my whole life because I was waiting for them to tell me it's stage 4 and that's a 15% survival rate.
Yeah. At that time like that, you know, we talk about, we pray, we have faith and so forth. But I've known people and that, you know, when something hits you like that, the faith issue kind of splits away because you're so alarmed. Did that happen to you?
No, I think I probably grabbed onto it as strong as I ever have. I was going to sleep because I couldn't sleep, you know, so I was playing John MacArthur sermons to fall asleep. I was kind of alternating between John MacArthur and Alistair Begg. So every night, I'd have to put on a sermon to fall asleep or I couldn't fall asleep. The first call that I made, I think, was to the elders at our church. And I've always been, you know, Calvinist, non-demonstrative, I'm not a put your hands in the air while worshiping kind of girl. And when this happened, you know, my husband and I joke now that everybody's charismatic in a foxhole. So I immediately went to the elders and I, you know, kind of gently said, listen, this passage in James about if any of you is sick, go to the elders and I'll have them anoint you with oil. I don't know if that's supposed to be symbolic. And, you know, our elder said to me, well, we've done it literally before. And I'm like, okay, good. I want that. I want the literal package of oil and I'm coming to the chapel. And so we met with our elders, I think even before I had my next appointment and they prayed over me. So I clung quickly and hard to all of these spiritual measures that I could possibly cling to. I mean, I was probably in Bible study like I've never been in my life. The Psalms suddenly meant so much more to me. And, you know, then we go And you start going through your appointments. And the first thing that we learned is that it's stage three and it's advanced, you know, stage three. I mean, I was very close to stage four, but I wasn't there yet. If the tumor has kind of grown through the bowel wall, that at that point, it was stage four. And I did have lymph nodes involved and other things like that. So, I mean, fortunate to have even caught it when we did. But the thing I kept having to remind myself, because you did feel angry at the doctors who dismissed you. And, you know, you go back and look at the scan and you go, now, wait a minute, there was this thing on the scan way back in March that why didn't they want to investigate that further? And then I remind myself, okay, God knew. It's not like God was like, oops, I didn't nudge that doctor enough to look at the scan more closely. So he knew that that was going to happen and I was going to be in this position. And so you just kind of cling to that providential wisdom that all of these things are working together for your good, even if the worst thing happens, which to me, I mean, I'll be honest, I was not a Pauline character in this who's like, I don't mind whether I, you know, live is Christ to, you know, and to die is to go to heaven. I'm like, no, I really want to live.
Yeah.
So I want to see my girls get married. Yeah.
These things can become empty slogans when we're actually facing the crucible.
Right. And so I did through a lot of study and a lot of listening to these sermons. And I mean, that was kind of my life for weeks. I did almost nothing but, you know, read various Bible studies and listen to sermons all day.
How did your family assist you in this regard?
My husband is the opposite of me in terms of he always thinks everything's going to be okay. And so, you know, he was kind of in that, I think it's going to be okay. You're going to be okay. We're going to fight this. It's going to be okay. And I'm the catastrophizer who's always kind of looking up stories going, okay, well, this person, and I'm a terrible researcher. I mean, I'm an obsessive researcher. So, which is not great in this situation because you can overload yourself with too much information. And that's exactly what I did.
And sometimes it's false because the internet
exactly.
is really.
And so my surgical oncologist now laughs and, you know, about my being a over-informed, high-anxiety patients, because I would come in with some really detailed question based on all of these studies I was reading, and he would kind of have to go, okay, that doesn't apply to you, or here's why that sounds worse than it is. So that was probably the other thing I did, was just doing a lot of research, and I would try to glom on to any story that was similar to mine where they beat the cancer. But unfortunately, when you go looking for those stories, you find a lot where that's not what happened.
How old were your kids when this occurred, and how did you help them deal with it?
15 and 10. So they're 16 and 11 now. And the first thing we did was we told them what was going on because there was at those ages, you're not going to hide from them the massive trauma that mom is going through right now. So we talked to them about it. We prayed with them a lot. I mean, we were praying as a family pretty constantly. And my 15-year-old dealt with it by becoming a food Nazi. You know, she's also kind of a researcher. She's like mom. And so suddenly she was trying to regulate everything I ate. So that's got sugar. Don't eat that, mom. That's got preservatives. Don't eat that. And my 10-year-old, you know, at that age, I don't think they really process how threatening this thing is. For her, she's just really quiet about it. And that was okay. You know, we just let her be quiet about it. And if she had questions, she could ask, but otherwise didn't want to put that worry into her mind too much. Just kind of let her know we're going to be praying for mom and we're trusting God that he's got us and this situation in his hand and he's well aware of what's going on.
You know, a lot of people, when this happens to them, they kind of retreat. They retreat into the privacy, which is totally understandable, of their house, their home, their family, their friends, because they need to have that kind of support. You, on the other hand, went out quite publicly. And I remember reading the tweet and sitting straight up that this was going on, and you were inviting both support, but also because you are, let us say, a controversial figure, you were inviting real cruelty in response. Why did you decide to be so public about your diagnosis?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, you know, I got the diagnosis in, as I said, right before Thanksgiving, and I think I went public with it right before we started treatment in January. And part of it was because I knew I was going to be canceling things. So you're coming out of a best-selling book. I've been doing a lot of interviews, a lot of coverage, and I knew that all of that was going to stop for a while. And part of it was this will just make it easier in navigating speaking requests or interview requests because people will understand this is what we're dealing with. And so I'm just not available in the way that I was before. Another reason.
But you could have done that privately. You could have called the people who had invited you to speak and say, look, I can't. I'm having some health issues. and been very vague and people would have understood. You didn't have to be quite so public as, I mean, very public as you were.
Yeah. And I, you know, I think I live my life as an open book. And so that was just sort of my natural instinct was to talk about what I was going through. And I think that's part of my whole career is I've written about the things and talked about the things that were personally impacting me, whether it was my husband's job and how we're going to navigate our finances and having children and our careers, or whether it was, you know, my political impulses or what I saw happening in the church. This was just kind of the next thing that this is what I'm going through right now. So it's now what I'm interested in. And of course, it was a little funny that it was happening during the rise of the MAHA movement, the Make America Healthy Again, because I became very interested in all of these studies and statistics showing that cancer is exploding in younger people, particularly this cancer, colon cancer, is rising at astronomical rates among women in my age group. And there's a question of why. Why are people under 50 now so much more likely to get this cancer?
Yeah, it was very rare when I was back in your age and younger that people your age had that diagnosis. It happened occasion, but not that often.
And in fact, they're saying that now people who were born in 1990 or later are more likely to have colon cancer than boomers or the previous generation, the silent generation before them. And so they're looking now at why is this happening? So that was kind of a natural interest as this was a big part of the news cycle. I'm going, I'm actually dealing with something that plays into all of this right now. And so it was natural for me to talk about it just because I think I just talked about everything. I think I'm just an open book. And this was the next page in the open book.
At the time, you quoted a Bible scripture. I think it's Proverbs, quote, "In their hearts, humans plan their course, but the Lord establishes their steps." Were you saying that your cancer was in God's will?
Yeah, I think it absolutely. I'm a Calvinist. I have to believe that this was God's will. So for good or ill, and it's always for good, this was God's purpose for me right now. I don't know why yet. You know, I mean, like I said, it was an absolute roller coaster year to go from hitting the New York Times bestseller list, something I never would have expected. And then just a couple of months later going, you now have an advanced cancer diagnosis.
Sure.
I mean, that's a really big high and a really big low. And, you know, even today, I'm sort of grappling with, okay, Lord, what is the purpose of this? And coming out of treatment, it was successful treatment. We got clean margins in my surgery, but I still have some higher risk factors for recurrence. And some people get sort of a clean getaway. They get what's known as a complete response, meaning the chemotherapy and the radiation are able to completely wipe out the cancer. And if you have a complete response, it's very likely it's not coming back. And so that's what we were hoping for. And I didn't get that. I got a good response to treatment. Tumor shrunk by about half, but it was still there. I still had an infected lymph node. I still had neural and vascular invasion. So even though we got clean margins, I'm very aware, okay, I have some higher risk factors for recurrence.
So your treatment, you had radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery.
Mm-hmm.
As far as you know, are you right now cancer free?
Yes. So right now, as far as I know, I have no evidence of disease. Now, after 5 years, they will say that you're cured, but sure, they're going to keep scanning you for 5 years. But I looked at that as the thorn in the side for me, that God wants me to not have sort of the clean getaway of the complete response. And instead, I have to sort of walk with the limp and I have to be reliant on him. So it's still in the back of my mind. But at the same time, it does drive you to your knees regularly.
And it puts in my mind one of the letters of St. Paul. I don't know which one, where he said, you know, I have a thorn in my side. You just mentioned that. And I've asked three times for the Lord to take it away. And he said, in weakness, you are strong, something to that effect.
Right.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, that is what I'm referring to. So, you know, I think God must know that with these gifts that he gave me. And I, you know, I really believe that Shepherds for Sale was a gift, that hitting the New York Times was a gift, because these, I mean, were really unexpected things, but that he's also saying, in order to keep you reliant on me, as you go through these things, as you get to experience the blessing of these gifts, I'm also going to ensure that you understand your mortality and where your strength comes from. And it won't be easy for you to forget it because you have this cancer diagnosis and you have this higher risk of recurrence. And so, you know, I'm very aware of my physical weakness, of my mortality, and the fact that, you know, I'm going to have to continually pray and continually seek and continue to ask, okay, Lord, can you preserve my life? in this next scan be clean? Can it not come back in the next 5 years? And so that's still something I'm walking through right now, because I would have loved to have gotten that complete response and go, okay, great, I'm done with that.
Well, the reason I'm being so meticulous here in this issue is I think that it's important for people who may not be Christians to understand how the faith mediates difficult circumstances. I've noticed in my own life, I'm Eastern Orthodox Christian, that when times are good, my prayer life abates. And when times get tough, suddenly I better pray. And I always beat myself up over that. But that's also, I think, part of the human condition.
No, I think it is. And that's why, you know, when you asked, did it cause me to draw back from my faith? No, it was very much the opposite. I mean, suddenly that was all I was doing for a while. And I think that there's a certain reward in that as well, because you have your moments when times are good that you question the authenticity of your own faith or the assurance of your salvation. And then something like this happens and you cling so hard to the Lord. You cling so hard to the scriptures that you're like, well, I must be the real deal, because my natural instinct in this is to run as fast as I can to the Father and just sort of throw myself at his feet and cry out for mercy. And that's what I did for many weeks.
And I think that illustrates another point that some people think that Christianity is about not suffering, and it's quite the contrary. Nobody who's a Christian necessarily, in fact, does escape the normal brickbats of life, and often has more because of their faith.
Yes. And it took some weeks. You don't immediately come to this place of, I feel peace, I'm okay with whatever happens here, Lord. That was not me. I mean, I was Hezekiah, face to the wall. I mean, just please, Lord, grant me my life. And eventually, and if you know me, this is absolutely a gift from the Lord, because this is not my natural bent. Eventually, I did reach this place of peace where I had faith that, look, even if the worst happens and I end up having to walk the road that I watched my aunt walk before me, which is long, slow treatment toward death, you're going to have me in that. And I can't project out and go, how will I emotionally and mentally be sustained in that moment? I just know that when I get there, Lord, you will provide that. Yeah.
I want to also ask you about people who may not have faith, because people who don't have faith experience these same things. Do you have any thoughts or advice for people who may not have the cross to cling to like you do, on how to get through the darkness of the night in such circumstances?
I will be honest with you, Wesley. And I thought this a lot through the process. I don't know how someone faces this without the hope of eternity. I really don't, because I don't think I could have gotten through it without that. And so I would encourage people to go, if you're going through something like this, use that as the moment to think about, what is my eternal destination? Where does my soul go from here? And to cry out and ask for relief, because we are encouraged to cry out and ask the Lord for, as David did, free me from this pestilence. So I did a lot of free me from this pestilence, Lord. So, you know, that would be, I look at people like Scott Adams, or there are other, if you're familiar with the Dilbert cartoonist.
Yes, he has prostate cancer.
Yes, who are high profile non-believers who are going through it. And I don't know how they do it. If there's a faith.
Well, Scott Adams has said he's going to commit assisted suicide when it gets too tough.
Well, I didn't see that. Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Maybe there's a certain pride there. Maybe it's pride that's driving them in that, I am going to be bigger than this cancer. Whereas I am someone who knew very much that I am small and broken, and I'm not bigger than this cancer, Lord. And I'm going to crumble under this if you don't hold me up.
You know, I've been working against euthanasia and assisted suicide for more than 30 years. And I came to understand that for many people, the ultimate purpose of society has shifted. It's shifted from protecting innocent life or promoting righteousness to eliminating suffering. And that's not the same thing at all. Obviously, everybody would want to eliminate as much suffering as we can, or at least mitigate it. But when that becomes the ultimate purpose, eliminating suffering can very quickly morph into eliminating the sufferer.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, you see these stories of euthanasia, and it was strange to suddenly be reading them. You know, before they were just sort of an intellectual exercise about, why are people doing this? And then suddenly you're in the situation going,
exactly,
this could be an option that someone's offering me at some point. And at that point, I also think about my children, because, you know, it's very much at the forefront of my mind that this is a moment where my daughters are watching and going, how authentic is your faith? the rubber's meeting the road here. How real is it to you? And I knew that they would be watching to see that. And not that I was performing my faith for them, but I was aware that, Lord, and I prayed this a lot, help me walk through this in such a way that they see how real you are. And I believe that seeing the answered prayers has been part of this, but it's also, if we get to that level of suffering, Lord, help me show them how meaningful the life you've imparted to them is and to me is, because that is reflected in our eternity. If we're giving up our life here, we're suggesting that there isn't something meaningful in what we're suffering here. And I believe that there is, and there is that refining fire. And I want my kids to see that and to know it, and to know that also I didn't just, you know, shrug and give up because it was painful.
Yeah. I think even more so because you're a leader in the society and Christian apologetics, and you put yourself out there. So you're now, people are watching. People are watching who may not be Christian. And one of the reasons I'm really glad you came on the show is I want people, and I have a lot of listeners who aren't Christian. This is not a religious podcast, that this is a way of life for people that brings great meaning and great comfort and great succor. And it's not just about looking down one's nose or thinking one is holier than thou. Quite the contrary, when it's done right.
Yeah. And look, for those people who are listening, what I can tell you is there was no Christian stoicism in me when this happened. I didn't sit back and go, oh, well, okay, you got this, Lord, and I'll just wait to see what happens. I mean, it was very much an active, on my knees, pleading. And that's kind of what I loved about going through the Psalms in this, is there were so many Psalms that I didn't attach meaning to before that suddenly I understood, like and I don't remember which Psalm it is, but I think it's a Psalm of David where he says, in my alarm, I said, every man is a liar. And I didn't really know what that meant until I was going through this. And suddenly, you know, you've had doctors tell you, you don't have anything. And then you find out it's stage 3 advanced. You know, I had doctors tell me, oh, it could be this, or this treatment could work. Or, you know, I mean, there's so many different studies about how do we approach this cancer? Do we do 6 rounds of chemo or 8 rounds of chemo? Do we do something called FOLFOX chemo or something called KPOX chemo? And as I'm experiencing all this, I'm suddenly, I don't trust these doctors now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I only say that, you know, in my anxiety. And that was the moment where I went, oh, I get in my alarm. I said, every man is a liar now, because I didn't get that before. And, you know, reading these Psalms where you see from David and other psalmists, just this, listen to me, Lord, almost, you know, grabbing the hem of his robes and shaking them and going, don't ignore me, Lord. Pay attention to me. Pay attention to my pain. And I think if you're not a Christian and you're not familiar with scripture, you don't see it that you don't know that that's how it is, that that's how the Psalms express our human pain and cries for help, that it is a pay attention to me, Lord, don't ignore me, Lord. And we think that Christians are just, well, God's will be done. It's not like that. It really is a wrestling with God. And going through this period has been an absolute wrestling for me.
I want to get to Charlie Kirk because, you know, when we agreed to do this interview, he was still alive. And I think what's happened since the atrocious assassination kind of dovetails with what we've been just discussing. Before we get to Charlie Kirk, just one more question about your own personal circumstance. Has this changed you? And if so, how?
Well, that's a good question. Yes. I mean, it certainly has. It's still new, Wesley. So I'm not entirely sure in what ways it's changed me. I feel like that's something I'm still living through right now because, you know, I just received my no evidence of disease diagnosis maybe 6-8 weeks ago. I can't remember now, but you know, I had surgery on June 30th, and it was several weeks after that that they told me, okay, we got clean margins. So it's definitely something I'm still processing. One of the things I realized was all of these goals that I had for myself, and I have a lot. I suddenly realized, you know, none of them matter if I haven't spent the time that I want to spend with the people who mean the most to me. And I know that's kind of a cliche answer, but there's a reason it's a cliche, because it's true. You suddenly go, if these are my last few years, I don't want to spend them on a speaking circuit or tucked up in a room writing my next book. I'm still going to do those things, but the urgency that I had wasn't at the same level that it was before that, when I felt like, hey, I've got 40 years. Or I may not have 40 years. I may have 5. And so that really reorients how you want to spend out your precious time.
Yeah. And I'm getting older, and I know exactly what you're talking about there. Let's talk about the late Charlie Kirk. As we're recording this, it was less than 2 weeks ago that he was murdered. You know, maybe it's my age, but I didn't pay that much attention to him at the time. I knew who Charlie Kirk was. You know, I'd see clips from time to time, but he wasn't like in my orbit of people I paid a lot of attention to. And after the murder, which I just obviously found horrific, I was honestly stunned by both the incredible outpouring of love around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I thought he was an American, you know, political activist. I didn't realize that he was actually a Christian apologist, but also the incredible hatred and vitriol that have been expressed toward him and his family and the people who are mourning him. What was I missing?
Well, I think you were missing what a lot of people were missing, and that is, and it's understandable, if you don't follow him and you didn't know his work, you saw the characterization that came through a lot of very large media megaphones, and you maybe saw clips of his most, let's say, bomb-throwing moments, and you didn't see the deep way that Charlie's faith informed the positions that he took. And I think what we're seeing now is a reevaluation of what he was out on college campuses doing and the kind of conversations he was having. And in a way, I'll be honest with you, going through the cancer diagnosis and watching this with Charlie has also been an encouragement, because there have been moments where, look, I did write this controversial book and it did get some pushback, some pretty strong pushback from some of the people I wrote about. And you think about your reputation and how you're being presented or how your words have been misconstrued or mischaracterized. And I think that was happening with Charlie. And then when he died, there was a reevaluation now. Everyone's sort of reevaluating what he spoke about and what he did. And they're seeing how much his Christian faith informed the views he took and the positions that he took. So he did a very different thing from the, in order to evangelize and draw people to Christ and witness to young people, I'm going to step back from politics because I don't want to put a barrier in the way. And I think that was kind of the old guard way, the seeker-sensitive way of approaching the next generation and witnessing to them for Christ. Whereas Charlie leaned in and said, yes, I am political. These are the policies I back, and I back them because I'm a Christian. And here's what scripture says about these various issues. And this is what has led me to my position. So again, you couldn't separate his Christian faith from what his policies positions were, and he didn't apologize for that. And so I think for the first time, you see a lot of people who were uncomfortable with that approach, his approach of saying, I actually do pick a side. You know, it wasn't the third way. We don't follow the left or right, understanding that no political party is perfect. But he did say, I pick a side. And that's different than we saw from most evangelical leaders in, you know, the previous couple of decades. And I also think what we saw last night at that, because we're recording this the day after. This phenomenal memorial, we saw that his using politics as a conduit to talk about faith has been incredibly effective with the next generation. And so I think there's also going to be a reevaluation of how do we approach people when we, as conservative Christians, and we're conservative because we're Christians, the Christian comes first, how that persuades a skeptical audience. Because I think suddenly you cannot deny that it was persuasive to a skeptical audience. And the older style of saying, let's avoid these things in order to bring people to Christ, has maybe been shown to not be effective in terms of this next generation as much as what Charlie was doing.
Yeah, but you don't have to be, if you're a Christian, you don't have to be a conservative. I'm thinking of Dorothy Day, who may be, at least in the Catholic Church, a saint who was very faithful. And she was, you might say, on the certainly the economically liberal side. So I think maybe rather than saying because he was Christian, so he's conservative, maybe it's he was Christian, so he was authentic.
Yes. Though, I mean, I will say we're in a different political moment now where I think it is much harder and nigh unto impossible, I'll just say, to say I am going to be aligned with the left and the Democratic Party and still see myself as a faithful Christian, unless you are very strongly opposing certain planks in their platform. Because I don't think you can be for abortion to the degree that they are and be any sort of spiritually mature Christian. I think someone can come to Christ having had those positions and they're still a Christian. They are newly sealed. But I don't think that you can have walked with the Lord for any particular length of time and fail to see that God's image in humanity, in the individual person, is precious. And that is why we defend life both at the beginning and at the end. And I don't think you can look at the gender ideology that has been very much championed by the left, this idea that I can transform the bodily integrity that God gave me and I can reject what I was created to be, a man or a woman, and still have any sort of formed biblical understanding of what male and female means. So, I mean, I think we're in a very different era where it is much, much harder because we're not just talking about economic policies. We're not talking about tax rates. We're not even talking about issues that I think are legitimately debatable issues for Christians. Things like, is climate change real? It is real. Okay. How much does human activity impact it? You know, those are fair and legitimate things for Christians to take various positions on. Whether a man can become a woman is not one of those issues.
And that may actually be the issue that we don't know for sure, but may have led to this horrible crime. Mm. You knew him behind the scenes. You know, you're a public person. People get views of who you are based on your public appearances. I'm a public person too, not as well known as you are, but the same thing has happened. People have sometimes said, well, Smith thinks such and such. I go, what? Where did that come from?
Right.
What was he like when he wasn't performing, if you will, and doing his public work as a private person and in private conversations?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I will say transparently, I didn't know Charlie very well. We had met on a couple of occasions and he had me on his show initially to talk about my book when it came out. And he was very much like-minded on the subjects that I wrote about and the way that I wrote about them. But there was really no difference between who he was publicly and who he was privately. I mean, what you saw was what you got. That's how he was. I mean, I can tell you the last in-person conversation I had with him was in, I think it was in August. I went to a TPUSA conference and spoke at one of their events, and he kind of grabbed me and said, here's what I want you to write about next. you got to start writing about some of these groups that are facilitating the incursion of Islam into the United States and what that's doing to impact the church. And I think you need to talk about that. So, I mean, what you saw was pretty much what you got. I mean, he was driven and he was passionate and he wanted to win, and he had an assignment for everyone, you know, including me. Here's the next assignment I want you working on. And as you hear everyone talking about, you know, the texts he would send out and, you know, the calls he would make, I mean, he was really about the mission. I think he was more missionally minded than entrepreneurial minded. That was just a side effect.
That's interesting. I've written 4 books with Ralph Nader, and it's the same way. What's he like behind the scenes? The same as you see him in public, except behind the scenes, he's funnier.
Right,
that's
right.
That's the only difference with Ralph. People are calling him a free speech martyr. Do you think, and I do think there's some truth in that, do you think he's a Christian martyr? Meaning, do you think he died for his faith?
Yes, I absolutely do. I have no compunction whatsoever in calling Charlie a martyr. And in fact, I was really gratified last night to see John Piper, who I do respect and have seen a little squishy on some issues. Didn't agree with Piper about everything, you know, some of his commentary leading up to the 2024 election. And so that was encouraging to me to see someone at Piper's level say, yes, Charlie Kirk, you know, he posted some Bible verses about not harming a hair on our head. And it was very clear that it was indicating that Charlie Kirk was a martyr. And for those who have said, well, he died for his position on transgenderism, and that's not the same thing as being a Christian martyr, I would just say, well, yes, because that was what informed his view. I mean, his faith, what scripture says about God created them male and female, the commands about not cross-dressing, these were the things that informed Charlie's position. In the same way that John the Baptist was beheaded for criticizing Herod's marital arrangements, the reason he criticized them was because of his faith. The same thing with Charlie. So, you know, I go, look, if he was murdered for taking a Christian position and speaking out about it, then yes, of course he's a Christian martyr.
And of course, the early church grew exponentially because of martyrdom. People going to be eaten by lions, singing hymns and a smile on their face. It's very interesting, the power of martyrdom. I heard on the news today that 100 million people around the world tuned in to that memorial service last night. I don't remember the last time, maybe the Olympics, where that kind of numbers were gathered together to look at the same event.
Yes. And, you know, you always want to be careful predicting revival or things like that. But I will just say, over the last week or so, I have seen things that have astonished me. People that I know who were strident atheists have started, and I have a friend who I just watched her say this publicly. I am now curious about church. I've gone to church twice. This is an atheist. And because they have something, I can see that they have something and I want to know what that is. And I saw another woman last night who was a former Muslim. She's not Muslim now, but she said, I look at how Christians are responding to this, and I can see that there's something different there. the way Christians are responding to this and those clips you talked about, the sudden reevaluation of Charlie's work, suddenly people are going back and looking and they're seeing things that they weren't aware of from him. They're seeing, you know, arguments that they didn't know he made, and they're seeing a gentleness. And that's kind of what I love, is I think so many people thought he was just this demagogue, and the record is being righted now. They're going back, they're watching his actual exchanges, and they're going, he wasn't actually. He could be very tough with political opponents, but when he was talking to someone standing in front of him who was a gender confused, you know, 20 something, he actually clearly had a loving heart for that person. And it was that loving heart that kept him from pulling punches about what the truth was, even as he was showing kindness to the individual standing in front of him. And I think that's what you're seeing all of these people seeing, not just Christians, but again, you know, Muslims, atheists, so many people saying something is going on there. And I want to know what it is that makes these Christians react this way.
We're almost out of time. And I do want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about your book,
Sure.
Shepherds for Sale. I was struck by the toughness of the subtitle, How Evangelical Leaders Traded the Truth for a Leftist Agenda. What truths do you think they have sacrificed, and why do you think they did?
Yes. So a number. I mean, I kind of go through the chapters issue by issue. One of the I would say false narratives that kind of came out after the book was that I was saying that every single person that I talked about in this book received a bag of cash at midnight from George Soros at the train tracks or something like that. And that was not the argument that I was making, though there was some of that. You know, on the one hand, you had issues like, as we just discussed, climate change. Maybe an issue that I do believe that Christians can in good faith disagree. You know, what's happening here? We can talk about the computer models. I'm married to a meteorologist, so it's a subject that we've talked about a lot in our home. But what you can't do is say, we are going to take money from very large, very wealthy secular left foundations like the Clinton Foundation, like the Gates Foundation, like the Tides Foundation. We are going to take this money. We're going to create an evangelical group that has a name like the Evangelical Environmental Network. And with this backing from the secular left, we are now going to create curriculum that renames the climate change activism into something like creation care. So we're going to rebrand it on something that sounds kind of churchy. And then we're going to push this curriculum out to ministries, to seminaries, to Christian colleges. And we're going to say that it is a gospel imperative that we take up the issue of climate change. Okay, at that point, you now have legalism, because I think we are very much free as Christians to disagree on this issue. But you have now accepted money to promote a particular narrative, and it is that Christians have a faith obligation to take up this issue. And that was where I went, okay, now you have sold out to a particular faction, and you're repackaging something from the progressive lingo that we would use when we debate this subject openly. So now, instead of climate change, it's creation care. And you are saying, you're putting a burden on people and saying, you as Christians must take up this issue and must take this position in order to be faithful Christians, in order to be following Christ and obeying his commands. So, I mean, they would say something like, if you're going to love your neighbor, you have to take up the issue of climate change. So again, at that point, I'm like, you're putting man-made doctrines, legalistic doctrines on faithful Christians who may disagree with you on this subject. And I think it's very reasonable to disagree on this subject. And so that was kind of the same thing I did with other issues like immigration. I think that Christians can, in good faith, have different views on what our border policies should be. But if you are twisting scripture and saying you have to welcome the stranger, and because you have to welcome the stranger as a faithful Christian, you need to support these particular border policies. And by the way, we're taking millions of dollars from George Soros's Open Society Foundation to create this evangelical group that is insisting that the only Christian position is to welcome the stranger and support amnesty. Well, again, at that point, I'm like, you are now twisting doctrine in order to support a particular political position.
So you're basically saying that they decided on the position and then look for the biblical scripture justifications for that position, as opposed to the other way around, which, for example, what you said in terms of male and female.
Right. And not just that. I mean, I will, and this is my impression, I will ascribe some motive in the sense that it looks very much to me like there has been a long-term effort to go, what progressive issues can we sort of baptize with churchy language? They're not so disaligned from biblical Christianity. I mean, obviously, you know, if you're promoting abortion in the name of Christ, and we see some of these, what I would call whitewashed tombs with their pride flags on their church, in that case, I mean, I think you're just a wolf. I mean, I don't think that's a Christian institution at all, even if it claims the name. But there are other issues where you go, it's kind of, you know, I don't know, can climate change or something like that be a Christian position? And it felt to me like what they were doing was looking for something that was popular culturally. It was embraced by our, you know, our dominant elite power centers like corporate America, like Hollywood, like academia, and say, we want to sit at that table too. And on this issue, if we twist and misapply these Bible verses, we also get to sit with those power brokers.
With the cool kids, as they say.
The cool kids table, yes. And that's what was going on. And not only that, they're going to pay us to do that.
Is your book aimed at evangelicals specifically and exclusively, or could people who are not part of that world benefit from it, do you think?
Yeah, I thought this was going to be a niche book when it came out. I had no aspirations or expectations of it getting the wide reading that it did. And I think it is because you have people who are not even Christian or evangelical themselves who recognize the importance of the church and moral authority in shaping our cultural positions and our outlook. I do think even if you're not a Christian, you can benefit because, look, if you look at something like the evangelical vote, it's, you know, kind of an estimated, depending on how you would define an evangelical, is anywhere from 25 to 30% of the electorate. The Atlantic has rightly called it America's most powerful voting bloc. So when you have these outside actors influencing the church to take certain positions and to preach about them from pulpits and to include it in their, you know, Bible study curriculum, because it's then going to impact what our policies are, it obviously matters to you, even if you're not a Christian, because those are the people who are some of the most motivated voters in our country. And if they're trying to sway them to one side or the other, it's going to impact you.
And, you know, it's not like this is new. Jimmy Carter, you know, was a Baptist. When he ran for election, he was very open about that. And I think that his faith actually helped push his human rights emphasis. Mm-hmm. So even though that's not a, quote, Christian, close quote, agenda, it certainly is an important liberal in the proper sense of that term agenda. That is human equality, nobody being abused and tortured and this kind of thing. So we've seen for many years in this country, in fact, back in the 19th century, that all politics also came out of religion.
Right.
So it's only relatively recently that there's been this kind of supposed ironclad separation between one's political views and one's faith.
Yes. And I think that we're seeing a quick and strong course correction on that. So suddenly, as I said, when talking about Charlie, you know, this idea that, well, as Christians, we're going to be beyond politics. We're going to stand outside of politics. That doesn't really work because politics is culture.
Yeah.
And there's too many things that the Bible speaks to now that are a part of our politics. So I think that's why there has become such a strong fight in the church, because we are now talking about primary issues. And I think this debate will go on. And to be honest with you, after last night, I think that the progressive church, to put it that way, is very much on its heels, because we're seeing a new generation that actually finds just a bold declaration of these are our positions because we are Christians a lot more attractive.
Interesting. One last question about one of your other books, your other book, Beside Every Successful Man, A Woman's Guide to Having It All, which I haven't read it, but I read the summary that it basically, you were saying that a woman's job, a wife's job, is to support her husband, and that in that support, you both will benefit in terms of family life and economically. Yet you've had an incredibly successful career. has the career that you've experienced subsequent to writing that book changed your opinions that you expressed in that book?
No, they haven't, because, you know, when I wrote that book, it was particularly aimed at women with young children or planning to have families. And even when I wrote that book, I wrote that our lives are long. As when we look at what our obligations are as women, there are things that we may want to do professionally, but our first obligation is to our home and to our family and to our children. And I do believe that. I'm very traditional in that way. And I think I'm theologically correct in that way as well, that husbands are to be the leaders in the home. And I think that they have the primary obligation to financially provide for the family. I do believe that.
Yeah, but the husband isn't just like a dictator. He's supposed to love his wife the way Christ loves the church, which means he puts his wife and his family ahead of himself.
Right, absolutely. And what I was going to say further is that we also have that Proverbs 31 model. It also doesn't say that women must be chained in the kitchen and doing, you know, laundry and nothing else, because we have a wife and a mother who was obviously entrepreneurial, who bought fields and sold them, who made investments, who, you know, made products and sold them to the community. And so in a way, that's what I'm doing. I'm making products through writing and selling them to the community. And, you know, anyway, getting back to, you know, part of what I wrote in that book was that our lives are long. There was a season when that book came out. I went on the Today Show. It was, you know, sort of this big splashy moment. And then I got pregnant. And then I went away. I mean, you know, that was when I very fortunately got to know some people at World, and kind of I look at it as my dormant years, you know, where I was a mom. I was still writing, but, you know, on a very part-time basis. I'm still a mom, but your kids get older and then they're in school and, you know, they're teenagers and they don't need that hands-on mothering in the same way that they did before. So suddenly you realize, okay, I have more time now to write about some of these issues or to explore some other interests I had. And so, you know, I don't think that there has been any shift in my view in that. It was simply that I finally, after writing about it back in 2008, 10 some odd years go by, I'm now entering that season that I talked about foreseeing way back then. And, you know, it's fun. I'm liking all the seasons.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today and being so open about a very difficult experience that you're still going through. And I'm hoping that it will be a benefit to listeners in terms of being able to cope with struggles that we all have to experience. Megan, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Wesley. It was a joy to be here.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.